Yang, it's here and now. In a moment, what is the difference between Gaza and the West Bank, and can differences between Palestinians be resolved? But first, flags are flying at half-staff in South Carolina, honoring 9 firefighters killed in last night's fire at a furniture warehouse in Charleston. It's the largest loss of city firefighters in America since 9/11. Here's Charleston Mayor Joseph Riley speaking at a news conference earlier today.
It is a tragic reminder of the profession of firefighting. People who put on the badge, prepared to go into a raging fire, to risk their lives any day, in any moment.
Reporter Noah Hagland of the Charleston Post-Courier has been covering this story. Noah, we know the fire is not completely out, but is there any news on how it started?
They have not released much information on the investigation at this point. The state law enforcement division, which is the state police and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, are on scene, and they're taking care of the investigation right now.
How many firefighters were there, and were the losses all from one station or several? Or
the mayor said this morning that all 9 are city of Charleston firefighters. I understand that 6 of the 9 came from a single station.
I know you spoke to a firefighter at that station. How are they doing?
Well, you know, not going to work isn't an option for them. So that's from what I'm gathering from firefighters and police officers, is that's how they honor their colleagues who have fallen, is they put on the uniform and they go back to work and they do their job.
Well, this is reminding others across the country of other fires. Here in Boston, we're reminded of the Worcester fire in 1999 that killed 6 firefighters, the Cafe Vendome fire 35 years ago yesterday, which also killed 9 firefighters. In fact, this fire in Charleston, this loss, I'm understanding, will be one of the worst in American history if you take out of the equation forest fire loss. This is one of the top, you know, one of the worst firefighting losses in American history. Is there anything to compare it to in South Carolina?
Mayor Joe Riley has been in office for 3 decades, and he said that during his time as mayor, they have not suffered any losses of this type. And in fact, I do not think they have lost a firefighter in a fire or building collapse during his time in office. Mm.
It was quite a blaze. We see the pictures on television. We understand the warehouse was right next to a residential neighborhood. How are people there responding to all of this?
They're immensely thankful for what the firefighters have done. One house, I talked to a resident who was in his backyard with a gardening hose, keeping everything as wet as possible. He said that the wind blew in the right direction, and that you know, the firefighters really did keep this from spreading to a residential neighborhood. And there was a gas station right next to the warehouse as well. So the potential for you know, damage to the outlying areas was also very real.
They also apparently pulled several workers out of the building before the roof collapsed. We understand that the roof collapse was sudden. Any sense of, you know, what happened? Should anyone have known it was going to collapse, or is it way too early for that kind of evaluation?
It's still pretty early on in the investigation. They're not releasing a whole lot of that kind of information at this point.
Yeah. We understand when it did collapse, so firefighters ran to a nearby car dealership, and you can see on the television video there's citizens, you know, look to be even car salesmen, suddenly hauling hoses and, you know, trying to fill in for the firefighters. Is that what happened?
It sounds like there was just an immense effort by anyone around. From what I understand, there were, you know, possibly hundreds of uniformed emergency police, fire, and other emergency workers on the scene last night.
And just a really powerful, poignant scene, saluting the fallen firefighters as they were brought out of the building.
Right. I talked to some witnesses who remembered seeing the flag-draped remains of the firefighters being brought out individually. And the fire chief, Rusty Thomas, escorting each one of them out as they were taken out of the building, and other firefighters and police officers saluting them as they were carried out. Very emotional. It sounds I can't really describe it.
Very emotional.
Exactly.
Noah Hagland of the Charleston Post-Courier, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
As President Bush meets with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in Washington today, the Middle East is at a stalemate. If you can, close your eyes and picture Israel, with the Mediterranean to the west, Jordan on the eastern border. Down in the southwest corner is the Gaza Strip, controlled by the Palestinian group Hamas after last week's takeover. 40 miles across Israeli land, on the border with Jordan, the second Palestinian territory, the West Bank, where the group Fatah is in control. Caught in between, hundreds of Palestinians trying to flee Gaza across Israel to the West Bank, trapped at the border crossings, which Israel has closed for fear that an influx of Gazans will destabilize the West Bank. So what happens now? Well, Greg Myrie is former Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. He's a veteran reporter in the region. He's been in the Palestinian territories dozens of times, and he joins us today from Washington. Greg, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. My pleasure.
And you remind us in your column this past week that this has been brewing since the militant Hamas, promising a less corrupt government than Fatah, won the elections early last year in a shared government with Fatah. You wrote about the conflicting histories of these two territories that reflect the differences in the groups. Remind us, why are the two territories different in temperament, if you will, if, you know, a territory can have a temperament?
You look at the West Bank, and it's more secular. People tend to be a little better educated. They're more likely to speak English, to have traveled a bit in the Middle East, if not the wider world. They would, if they did leave the West Bank, they would go to Jordan or Syria or Lebanon or further abroad. In Gaza, you have a poorer population. Most of those people are refugees or descendants of refugees from the 1948 war. It's a much tinier, poorer, crowded territory. People are more religious. The life centers much more around the mosque in Gaza than in the West Bank, although both places are Muslim.
And Greg, remind us why this is. Take us back to 1948 when Israel was created. Egypt annexed Gaza. Jordan took control of the West Bank. Tell us how that influence affected what we're seeing today.
In the 1948 war, many Palestinians fled or were forced from their homes. And Gaza in particular became a real center for many Palestinian refugees. And Egypt controlled Gaza from 1948 until the 1967 war, when Egypt was driven out. So the Gazans were very much geared towards Egypt. This is where the people in Gaza might go to university or travel. So there's much more an Egyptian mentality. Again, a poor, more traditional society.
And influenced by one group in particular in Egypt.
Right. Many of the Gazans, when they would go to Egypt, especially those who were maybe at a university or studying or spending time there, might be influenced by the Muslim Brotherhood, this Islamic group that dates back more than 70 years in Egypt. And in fact, Hamas, which was formed in 1987, really grew out of the Muslim Brotherhood. Many of its leaders were students in Egypt, and as they came back to Gaza, they brought the ideas and the thinking of the Muslim Brotherhood, and this is where Hamas was created 20 years ago.
And the West Bank, you say that Jordan, which controlled the West Bank, didn't allow as much of a Palestinian persona to evolve.
With Jordan's control of the West Bank from 48 to 1967, it was a different situation. Many of the Palestinians there, they were in the Jordanian education system. There was not this Islamic fundamentalism, that more an issue in recent years. But Jordan very much saw these people as part of Jordan. So there was a different situation there, and it led to the creation of some differences. Now, all Palestinians see themselves as being of the Palestinian people and seeking a single state. I mean, I've never, ever met a Palestinian who said there should be two separate entities here, two separate states. So there is, of course, many, many things that they have in common. But their personalities are very distinct and very different. And any Gazan or any West Banker will tell you that.
And that's become pointed in the last couple of weeks. Well, let's fast forward to today. Israel withdrew settlements from Gaza in September 2005. There are still Israeli settlements in the West Bank. How is that impacting the two regions?
There was certainly a great hope back in August and September of 2005 when the Israelis left that now the Palestinians in Gaza could work, although they would not have an independent state, they could work as if they had one. But there's just been problems from the get-go there. The Palestinians continued to fire rockets into Israel after the Israelis left. There were certainly many unresolved issues about movement. How would people and goods get in and out of Gaza? And that quickly fell apart despite a U.S. Brokered plan to address that issue. So we've just seen basically nonstop conflict for almost 2 years in Gaza, and conditions in Gaza have gotten worse and worse. And with Hamas winning the elections in January of 2006, Gaza in particular has been further isolated because this is the Hamas stronghold. So conditions in Gaza have gotten worse and worse. In the West Bank, things are not going very well either, but it's a little more stable. There's a little bit better economy. Fatah is in control, so it's a bit more stable there. But Gaza has really been a mess for the past couple of years.
Well, now nations that have withheld funds from Palestinians because of Hamas's pledge to destroy Israel have, you know, in the last couple of days released those funds, reestablishing diplomatic ties with Abbas in the West Bank. Where do we go from here, Greg?
Well, we've certainly seen a very swift change in Western policy. The United States and the European Union say that they're going to restore direct financial assistance to the Palestinian government. This is something they had withheld since last year when Hamas came to power. But it may be a silver lining around a very large and dark storm cloud, I think. The money will help President Mahmoud Abbas, who's in the West Bank, could uplift the West Bank economy. But you're certainly going to see a lot of problems, I think, related to this as well. Mahmoud Abbas wants to be seen as the president of all the Palestinians, not just the West Bank. If he's receiving money from the United States and Europe, many Gazans, I think, will see him as rightly or wrongly, fairly or unfairly, we'll see him as somebody who's collaborating with the United States and Europe, taking the money, using it for the West Bank, and not using it for Gaza. So this could make his position much shakier, an already shaky position even more difficult. So it could give him a temporary boost. The idea is to strengthen Abbas and other moderates in the West Bank, and one can certainly understand that thinking. But it may also have the effect of hardening the divisions between the West Bank and Gaza.
And as we said yesterday in the program, even though Abbas has said he's not going to abandon Gazans, there's a tricky slope there because if he funnels money into the region, it may fall into the hands of Hamas. But you and others are writing that Hamas may have been as surprised as anyone to have won in last week's battles. What is the sense that Hamas really wants to rule separately?
Yeah, I don't think Hamas wants this. This is by no means their ideal situation. They see themselves as leading not only the Palestinian people, they see themselves leading a movement to create an Islamic State through the whole region, and ultimately they don't want Israel to exist.
Well, I want to ask you about that. Is there any sense of that changing, Hamas changing its stance towards Israel? Greg Myrie is a former New York Times correspondent in Jerusalem. He's writing a book on the Middle East conflict. We'll have more from Greg. And this quick reminder, later in the show, we're going to meet a psychologist who's encouraging fellow therapists to offer free treatment to returning American veterans, and she's getting a big response. That's Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now. We're back with more from Greg Myrie, former Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times, on the stalemate in the Middle East between the two Palestinian territories controlled now by two factions. President Bush today saying President Mahmoud Abbas leads all the Palestinians, despite the fact that last week the rival Hamas militants defeated Fatah in Gaza. Greg, before the break, you were saying that it's Hamas's stance that Israel should not exist. Is there any sense of that changing? Because if Hamas and Fatah do manage to reunite without Hamas renouncing that pledge to destroy Israel, do Palestinians risk losing this financial support they've just received from the West?
Well, that's certainly going to be the problem. Again, if Mahmoud Abbas gets the money and doesn't spend it on Gaza, he'll be seen as only the leader of the West Bank Palestinians and not all the Palestinians. If he does send money to Gaza, then he has no real way of controlling how that money is spent because Hamas will be in charge. So he'll be, in effect, working with Hamas. It's hard to see how Hamas can run Gaza by itself, but it's also difficult to see how Mahmoud Abbas can claim to be president and have a government that serves just the West Bank. So I think at some point they're going to have to find a way to get back together. And I'm sure this is what all Palestinians, or the vast majority of them, want. They don't want two separate entities. But it's hard to see how they're going to bridge that gap, because they've been going in different directions. We've seen it very clearly since the Hamas election a year ago. But we've seen this general trend of Fatah getting weaker in the Palestinian areas for, you know, a decade or so, and Hamas getting steadily stronger basically for the 20 years since it was created.
We were hoping that you were going to look in your crystal ball and see something clearer than that. No?
Well, I have certainly learned the hard lesson of predicting events in the Middle East. So I don't want to be too specific, because I'm sure I'll be wrong within 24 hours. But I think the larger issue is the problems have gotten more difficult. There was a sense that perhaps the Palestinians, Hamas, would become more moderate, would be willing to recognize Israel, that Israel and the West could resume a dialogue and interaction with the Palestinian government and get back to peace talks. I think we're in a more difficult position than we've been at any point. You've just seen us go from the negotiations of the 1990s to the Palestinian uprising since 2000, to the election of Hamas, to now the division of the Palestinians into two states. So I think we're still very much on a downward slope, and I don't think any increase in Western aid, while it may help alleviate the suffering of the Palestinians, and that is certainly a positive development, but in terms of the larger question of a political solution and finding the creation of a Palestinian state and creating a secure Israel, these larger questions, I think we're still very much on a downward slope.
Is there anything that Israel can do? Is there anything actually that anyone can do outside of the region, or is this something that Palestinians, you know, is this something that they first have to resolve?
I think, yes, the Palestinians are going to have to sort this one out largely on their own. Until the Palestinian, the two main factions, Hamas and Fatah, are dealing with one another, I think we're really, there's not a lot that can be done. Arab states, Egypt in particular, have tried to mediate for well over a year between the two factions, and the split between them has just gotten worse. So I really think this is something that the Palestinian factions are going to have to achieve on their own before we can see any forward progress.
Does anyone see in the future the possibility that an Arab state might annex one of the territories and leave the other one as a Palestinian state?
I don't really see that right now. Egypt is very, very nervous about what's happening in Gaza, because they have the Mubarak government. Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, is very worried about the Muslim Brotherhood and any radical Islam in his own country. So the great Egyptian fear is that the chaos of Gaza will spill over into Egypt. And so Egypt is very, very nervous and wants to contain that, but they don't want to take Gaza over because they see it as such a mess. Now, there have been raised occasionally, mostly by Israelis, that Jordan might take control of the West Bank, but the Palestinians would certainly resist this. So I don't think the Palestinians would accept any sort of Arab action as a protectorate or a leader of their territories.
Meantime, Greg Meyer, you've been in the territories. We've described, you know, hundreds of Palestinians held up at the border crossing, trying to cross over Israel land to get to the West Bank from Gaza. What's going on? I mean, how are people, are there people who, Palestinians who aren't affected by this, who go about their, you know, maybe a life of sheep herding and aren't touched by this? Or is the country, as it would seem, just sort of frozen? I mean, what do people do?
I think there's a real sense of what's going to happen to us in Gaza. People have just seen things go from bad to worse to this sort of free fall. Things have just come to a standstill. You cannot have an ordinary life there. Goods cannot come in and out easily, only when Israel allows them in and out, which Israel is making sure that people, there is enough to eat and things like this. But in terms of conducting business, of trying to maintain an ordinary life, I don't think we're going to see that, and I think life will very much grind to a halt. It was already operating at a very low level, and it's not clear where Hamas is going to get the money or the resources to govern Gaza.
Is there any chance, Greg, that the Palestinians in Gaza will themselves turn against Hamas, perceiving Hamas as the group that's, you know, sort of led to this impasse?
We haven't seen that. And if there was an election held today, I'm not sure it would be all that different from what we saw at the beginning of 2006. A lot of the people, certainly in Hamas and its supporters and even ordinary people in Gaza, will look around and say the problems that Hamas is facing are because Israel and the West have created this boycott and this isolation. They don't blame Hamas for failing. They blame the embargo, as they see it, is causing the problem. So it's possible, but this is something that Israelis and the United States sort of hoped would happen. I really don't think it has happened at this point.
Greg Myrie, former New York Times correspondent in Jerusalem, now writing a book about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Greg, we'd love to have you back when that's finished. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. How do doctors make diagnoses? Well, Dr. Jerome Groopman will deconstruct a false diagnosis that I received. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, startling statistic, the rate of male veterans who commit suicides twice that of men with no military service. What does that mean for returning vets? That's after the news, Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now. If you are a veteran and you are male, you are twice as likely to die by suicide than men who never served in the military. That's the finding of a new study published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. Its authors say the study should serve as a red flag for mental health professionals as troops in Iraq and Afghanistan return home. Joining us is Mark Kaplan, professor of community health at Portland State University and lead author on the study. Mark, let's get to some of the hows first, how you did this, and then maybe we'll come up with some of the whys, you know, why it's happening. These numbers that you're reporting are much larger than previous studies. What accounts for that gap?
Most past studies conducted on U.S. veterans relied almost exclusively on patient populations from the Department of Affairs systems. Much of what we know about suicide and the risk of suicide derives from studies that focused on Vietnam-era veterans. Many of the studies also focused on suicidal ideation or thoughts and attempts among veterans rather than on mortality, which is what we did.
Well, let's address that. So if the previous studies were from the Veterans Administration, what might your study add that they might not? I mean, what would be lacking in those, let's say?
What we did was gather information from the ongoing National Health Interview Survey, and we pulled data for individual years in order to put together a large enough sample that we could follow over 12 years to determine the risk of suicide in that population.
This was 320,000 male veterans over the age of 18, men who served in the military at some point between 1917 and 1994.
That's right. World War I through the first Gulf War.
What'd you find?
The key finding is that male veterans in the general population, U.S. population, are twice as likely as their non-veteran counterparts to die by suicide.
Hmm. When we first heard this statistic, this very chilling statistic, we wondered if it at all correlated to what we've heard about men in general having higher suicide rates because men tend to own guns more than women tend to own guns. So within men, do veterans, who now, as you say, have twice as high a suicide rate, tend to have more guns than non-veterans? And was that a factor?
It always is a factor. Higher probability that veterans use firearms as a mode of suicide compared to non-veterans. 84% of the vets versus the general population was at 55%. Mm-hmm. Veterans were 58% more likely to die of firearm suicide than non-vets. Mm-hmm. And another important finding, veterans are more likely to own guns than are individuals in the general population. Nearly half of all vets own a gun, reported owning a gun, versus 32% of the general population. And finally, we found that veterans who own guns were 21% times more likely to use firearms than those who did not own a firearm.
Right.
So they're more likely to die of guns or more likely to own guns.
And so that might be one of the answers to the big question, why? You know, that in the moment they may have access to something that is, you know, so quick and irreversible, a gun, as opposed to a non-veteran who may have suicidal thoughts but may not have access to that gun. That's maybe one answer to the question of why, but why else do you think veterans are twice as likely to commit suicide?
There are a couple of ideas that we've addressed. One is the possibility that there are issues of disability and activity limitation that also turn out to be a significant factor in this population of veteran suicide decedents.
Their quality of life is less. They're injured,
exactly.
Maybe.
Exactly. And this may have implications for the current cohort of military personnel who have served in Afghanistan and or Iraq. And one of the things that we looked at was, do activity limitations, that is to say, people whose daily functioning is impaired, that is, they're functioning at school, at work, at home, possibly even in relationships, what role does that play in their risk of dying of suicide? So that can be a factor. There are a host of other things that deal with the mental health care systems. Most people who complete suicide have had contact with a health care provider shortly before their attempt. And the question is, how prepared are we for individuals who are suicidal, particularly men, and that probably has implications for our study as well.
Well, it's something that the military is definitely becoming aware of. We understand that the Army is expanding a program at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to try to get these behavioral health staff members directly to soldiers instead of troops having to go to a special mental health facility. A recent report by the VA's Inspector General found that many of the agency's hospitals lack the proper, you know, health care training. And the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs is considering a bill that will direct the VA to develop a suicide prevention program. Given what you know, the numbers that you've crunched, it sounds as if you are backing that up.
Well, you know, keep in mind that our study focused on vets, not only those who are affiliated or who have received care through the VA system, but the general population. Three quarters of all vets seek care through non-VA facilities. Mm-hmm. What we're calling for in our study is that mental health care providers outside the VA system need to be more attentive to the signs of suicidal intent and access to firearms. And by mental health care providers, I would include primary care providers. Most of the mental health care in this country is not delivered by psychiatrists or psychologists, but through the primary care sector, nurse practitioners, for example, or family docs. So they also need to be trained as to or alerted to the risks associated with individual men who have served in the military.
Because right now they provide the national tracking system. Paul Rykoff, who's the executive director and founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, says that there's no method to track veterans coming home, no system, no national registry. So, as you say, it's up to the primary care physicians and family to be
exactly.
The ones looking for this.
Exactly. And, you know, there are reports coming out through the media. According to a recent Washington Post, every month, 20 to 40 soldiers are evacuated from Iraq because of mental problems, according to the Army. So we don't know the true rate of psychiatric morbidity in that group.
And before we let you go, I just want to note, you are talking about the clear suicides. It doesn't sound as if you've incorporated in your study what some people might call slow suicide. Drinking, drug abuse, car accidents.
We have approximately 30,000 suicide deaths per year in this country. Some have estimated that that figure might be off by 25 to maybe up to 50% for reasons that you've just mentioned. Slow suicides, people who are involved in car crashes who die, it might have been suicidal, but yet it was officially recorded as something other than that. We don't really know the true suicide rate, and we probably will never know that. Perhaps with people who die of self-inflicted gunshot wound, it's a little clear that was the intent there was to complete suicide. But in terms of other forms, other modes of suicidal behavior, it's unclear. Mm. So we need to be very careful about, you know, treating these as firm figures. And we don't know. We don't know that in the general population, and we don't know that in the veteran population. Mm. But one thing we do know is that the vast majority of vets do not receive their care, and therefore the providers need to be more attentive to the risks associated with individuals who served in the military.
Mm. Mark Kaplan, professor of community health at Portland State University. His study on veteran suicide rates appears in this month's issue of the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Professor Kaplan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on your program, Robin.
And you're listening to Here and Now. We'll be right back. Well, as we just heard, many of the returning Iraq and Afghan war veterans are not getting the mental health care they need because the military mental health care system is strapped, but also because many private therapists are refusing to take on military patients. They don't want to deal with the headaches that come with the TRICARE military insurance program. They say TRICARE is cutting payments to private therapists, and the process is filled with red tape. Dr. Barbara Romberg is a clinical psychologist from Washington, D.C., and she's also decided the headaches of TRICARE aren't worth it, but she's decided to turn a negative into a positive, bypassing the military system by offering free treatment to troops and encouraging other therapists to do the same. And she joins us now. And Dr. Romberg, first of all, how bad was it? I mean, why did you decide to create your organization, which is called Give an Hour?
Well, about 2 years ago, it became very clear that so many troops were going to be coming home with the difficulties that we would expect them to have, given what they're experiencing. It's not that they're more pathological, these folks coming home, than the rest of us here in the U.S., but that what they're experiencing is horrific stress and trauma. And so it was very clear just from the numbers that we were going to need to step up and do something, and that the military would not be prepared to handle the family members and the military personnel themselves.
What about the insurance payments? Because TRICARE does say that they offer the same payout to therapists as some corporations do.
Well, that may be true that they do, but again, the system can't possibly absorb the numbers coming home. And many mental health professionals like myself haven't participated in the TRICARE program. I haven't for many, many years. And so to now go back and to go through the process where there is quite a lot of red tape and the payments are less than I make in my regular private practice, to me, it's more appropriate for us to just step up, give an hour, provide services for these folks. They deserve it. We can do it. And that's why we started this.
Well, so how's it going? How many therapists have you heard from?
We now have nearly 400 mental health professionals on board. They're ready to roll. We're recruiting more and more. More and more are signing up each day. So we expect to have thousands of mental health folks signed up by the end of this summer.
Well, meantime, what are warning signs that families can look for?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, there are many things that we see with these folks coming back again because of the level of stress and trauma that they've experienced. You might see a loved one who seems very withdrawn, who seems quite preoccupied with their own thoughts, someone who maybe is using substances more frequently, having more drinks in the evening, someone who seems more angry, more irritable, sleep difficulties, problems concentrating.
Well, you know, doctor, and some people might say, well, yeah, you'd have all of those things if you were plunked in the middle of a war. Obviously, somebody would have some reentry issues.
That's true. And indeed, we would expect all of those reentry issues. It's the duration and the intensity and the severity. Some people are able, depending on what they experienced, depending on how they experienced it, to move through that. Other folks are not, and they become more and more symptomatic, more and more distressed, and it interferes more and more with life.
Right. So, you know, obviously, if someone is, you know, coupled with that, also waiting months to see a therapist, it could be a perfect storm.
Absolutely. And again, the military community, these are proud folks, and for them to even acknowledge that they need help is a huge step, and then to not have access to anyone is just unacceptable.
The therapists that you're hearing from, how, you know, many troops can they take? Obviously, they still have their private practices.
Well, it varies, but everyone has absolutely said, I will add an hour to my practice. I will take on one case, one family, one individual, one child from a family. Some are saying they'll take more. So it depends on that individual, but everyone so far is very eager to step up. They've been looking for something to do and are happy to do it.
And is there one thing in particular about this war in particular that therapists need to know about?
This is a war where there really isn't a front line, so folks are under stress 24/7 when they're there. There's a lot of people coming home with traumatic brain injuries that may be very difficult for them or their family members to understand even what that is. So there are specific characteristics, and we're going to make sure our providers know that as these folks are coming home.
Dr. Barbara Romberg, a clinical psychologist from the Washington, D.C. area. Her organization is called Give an Hour, encouraging therapists to offer free therapy to troops returning from war. For more information, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Dr. Romberg, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, after a quick break, when Middle America met experimental musician John Cage on the TV game show I've Got a Secret, here and now. Van Young, It's Here and Now. You never know what you're going to find on the internet. Oh, look, there's John Cage appearing on the 60s TV game show, I've Got a Secret.
Will you tell our panel, please, what your name is and where you're from?
My name is John Cage. I'm from Stony Point, New York.
John Cage is the avant-garde experimental musician, 48 at the time of this recording. I've Got a Secret was the quiz show with the celebrity panel, including the late Kitty Carlisle, who tried to guess a mystery guest's secret. Well, on one show in 1960, the guest was John Cage, and in an unusual move, host Gary Moore dispensed with the guessing part and told the audience that instead, Cage would perform a whole piece and they should brace themselves.
The instruments that he will use include a water pitcher, an iron pipe, a goose call, a bathtub, five radios all hooked up, and a grand piano.
And that's not the half of it. The piece, called Water Walk, also made use of ice cubes, a rubber duck, and a mechanical fish. Stephen Drury is a pianist and faculty member at the New England Conservatory of Music here in Boston. Stephen, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
By the way, what did you think of this when you heard it?
It's so amazing on so many different fronts. I'm tempted to kind of slip into Cage's own persona and say, isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
Which was always his reaction to anything that would happen. I mean, he was just delighted by the world around him. And to see this coming out of old black and white TV and Gary Moore standing there smoking his cigarette. And it's amazing.
It's wild. And we want to hear more of your reaction. We will hear more of it. But first, you're something of a Cage expert. You directed a year-long Cage festival in the late 80s. You've performed premieres of Cage pieces. For those who don't know the composer well, where does he stand in music?
I'm tempted to say he stands above it all or before it all. I mean, he was so influential in the way music in every genre is done today. I mean, the way pop bands incorporate sampled noise, the way we think of any sound being something that we can use.
Any sound is music.
Any sound can be music. And in fact, he says something about, I think Gary Moore asks him, is this music? And he says,
I consider music the production of sound. And since in the piece which you will hear, I produce sound, I would call it music.
In that quiet voice of his.
It's, you know, for someone who is so radical and thought of as being such a monster, you know, such a revolutionary.
Provocateur.
Yes, exactly. Everything was very calm with Cage. He had that zen-like calm center around which swirled this revolution he created.
Give us a sense. Again, we're going to hear the music that he played on I've Got a Secret, but let's just hear a little bit of his sounds, songs that you think really represent the spectrum of Cage.
Closest to what he was doing on this TV show is a piece called Music Walk, which is for any number of musicians surrounding a grand piano with some radios and some noisemakers. And it's kind of this chaotic circus of sound. It's very similar to what you see Cage do on this video, except imagine 8 or 9 John Cages, all very carefully not trying to bump into each other as they go from the piano to one of the radios, to the duck call, to a bucket of water, to some firecrackers. This recording is me and me and me and a couple more me's all overdubbed in the studio.
Under the morning paper, she thought that she'd be.
That's Stephen Drury performing John Cage's Music Walk. You say there's another piece, Variations 2. What does this tell us about Cage?
That tells us how far Cage could go into noise. This is one of my favorite records when I was growing up. I played it so many times on the LP that, you know, practically turned into powder. And I was overjoyed to find that at 10 times what I spent on the LP, they've re-released it on CD. And the electronic rawness and screaming noise of this and sounds from outer space, all done on the inside of a piano with phono cartridges. This is played by David Tudor. And this is as extreme as Cage's noise-making gets.
Thank you. Take That, Metallica. So those are the sounds of John Cage that have been recorded. Now let's get back to this. I've Got a Secret, 1960. Here he is in a black suit, close-cropped hair, very deferential to Gary Moore.
And very formal of the times, coming out of the 50s. And that continues in the performance. He very formally and methodically goes up to the piano and hits the inside and blows on the rubber duck and turns on the ice cube blender. One task to the next, just doing it.
Almost as if you were watching a percussionist in a symphony orchestra, only now he's playing, you know, piano, radio, as you said, rubber ducky. And this is all in front of a studio audience and then a live audience at home. Let's listen. Now, you know, while we're listening to this, Stephen Drury, the audience is, you know, members of the audience, we can hear they're laughing.
He says a wonderful thing early on. Gary Moore says, you know, people might laugh. And he says, well, I've always considered laughter better than tears.
And they do laugh. How do you think this was hitting people in 1960?
Oh, man. I mean, the whole shape of the culture and of the mass media was so different back then. I mean, we're thinking of the Kennedy inaugural with Pablo Casals playing solo Bach on the cello and Robert Frost giving an address. And that kind of willingness to accept highbrow culture, for lack of a better word, that kind of willingness to accept people that do what they do quietly with a lot of training and seriousness and patience and an awareness of history and to make time for it, rather than cut to the next big noise.
Yeah. When you say make way for the big noise, do you think people then thought this was just another big noise? Or were they, how were they viewing experimental music?
Well, Cage, I don't mean to underplay the radicalness. And he certainly wasn't part of the mainstream.
Right.
In a way, he's more closer to the mainstream now because of the mainstream's acceptance of everything,
right,
of rock and roll and all the the noise that rock and roll brought. But, he was a little bit from outer space back then. But it just strikes me as so interesting that this popular TV show would make room for this little bit of outer space.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were maybe two people in the audience at most who'd ever heard of this guy and thought what he was doing was just absolutely insane. And, you know, I'm sure he was aware of that, too. But the fact that he gets up there and just does the performance and explains very simply what he wants to do and trusts the work to get out is what he's all about. It's really wonderful.
Stephen Drury, pianist, faculty member at the New England Conservatory of Music here in Boston, and John Cage, aficionado. Thanks so much for coming in to share this moment in television history with us.
Always a pleasure to talk about John.
And by the way, the works of Cage and other contemporary composers are being performed throughout the week at the New England Conservatory. For more on that, or to see the original I've Got a Secret video, or to download a podcast, go to our website, here-now.org. We'll leave you with Cage's Variations 2. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.